Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you like it, please share it. Leave us a review where you found it. It really helps us out. You can also find recipes and videos and information on just about everything else you hear today on our website, splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get to this week's show. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Some foods are polarizing. Green peppers, mint chocolate, pineapple on pizza, but the OG, like the one that rose from the primordial muck of love it or hate it foods, is the oyster. The author Tom Robbins once wrote that eating a raw oyster is like French kissing a mermaid, and that sounds about right to me and also sounds pretty good. But some people gag at the idea of it, they hate the slippery texture, some people love the taste of seawater, and some people, you know, they just roll their eyes at how precious and snobby the whole thing seems. Well, this week, our show is all about oysters, but while I can't promise that we can do anything for you if you don't like how they taste, I can tell you that oyster stories are far less prissy and probably way more interesting than you might have thought. Like later on, we're going to learn about the man who helped make the oyster's reputation as a classy food. We're going to get a lesson in the seagull test. And we have a story that just might make you cry. But first, we have to start in the water. Ryan and Travis Croxton are cousins and fourth-generation oystermen in the Chesapeake Bay of Virginia. Only they weren't meant to be. The last Croxton who harvested oysters was their grandfather. But when the family's leases for their oyster grounds were up, Travis and Ryan couldn't resist their family lore. They renewed those leases and tried to learn how to farm oysters. And they are here with us today. So hey, Ryan and Travis.
How's it going?
Hey, how's everything?
It's awesome to have you with us. So Ryan, when you guys first started out as oystermen, what was different about what you were doing than what, say, your great-grandfather was doing 120 years ago?
Well, the first thing that was different is we literally did not know what we were doing. So we got to start from a fresh perspective. And I'll often equate this like with the, you know, starting of our country, where you kind of got to rewrite a constitution and kind of reevaluate what everybody else was doing and then do something fresh and new that kind of took the best practices of everywhere. And that's kind of where we were. We had a system of dredging and so forth that had been our legacy that really hadn't worked for us. It basically left the bay at a point where we didn't have any oysters left. So we had to think of something new. So, you know, it started with investigating and learning how to do something different.
Mm. When you say the dredging and the legacy of it, meaning the oysters were essentially way over harvested by that point, right? By the time you started, like there weren't actually many oysters in the water anymore.
Right. So it was a wild industry that had grown in the Chesapeake Bay, and that was done through dredging the bottom. It's basically these, I'm trying to think of a good way to characterize them. They're these rakes that you drag along the bottom, and it pulls up all sorts of bycatch, and it pulls up oysters at various stages of growth. And then you kind of have to cull through it and throw everything back that you don't want. It's just a really inefficient way to do it, but it also leaves the area where you're growing oysters much worse off than you found it. Plus, you're depleting the number of oysters. You're just not putting anything back. You're not letting it rebound. So we needed to completely rethink it.
So you guys started farming oysters, which was, I think, in 2001 you started, right? This was a new idea then. Tell us what farming oysters is all about.
Well, this is Travis here. We had the history of the oyster leases, but no equipment, no land, no boats, no property. So we just had to figure out, hey, how is everyone else in the world growing oysters? And we just, at the time we were Netscaping, not Googling. we were looking for, on AOL, looking for how do you grow oysters, and realized that every region in the world except for the Chesapeake and the Gulf of Mexico had adopted aquaculture. And that's because they had to, because they had decimated their oyster population centuries before us. The Gulf and Chesapeake were so prolific and massive that it took more centuries to decimate that population. I mean, essentially, oh, wow. It's the Lorax story, right? I mean, mankind takes everything that it can from resources until there is no more. For us, the bay was at 1% of its historic population, and And
1%.
Yeah, it was a dead industry. So that's why we thought, hey, now's a good time for us to jump into business. but we thought with aquaculture, we could prove that you could grow oysters. There were oyster gardeners that were basically some, you know, retirees that were tying up oyster floats to their docks and having success growing the native Virginica species. And so we said, well, why don't we take that on a commercial scale? And we jumped in.
And that's an important part of it, is that it was the native species, and that was a really exciting aspect to this, was we weren't just figuring out how to grow oysters, we were figuring out how to restore our native population. Because at the time, 2001, when we started getting into this, you know, they were talking about putting the eastern oyster, a moratorium on them, so putting them on the endangered species list, and possibly even introducing a Chinese oyster to replace it. So it was a scary time, because it might have meant the end of, you know, our native species.
Yeah. So, but what is farming oysters? I mean, I think most people think of oysters as the dredging you talked about. You go out, you find them, you just start digging. So farming is putting oysters back in to the water?
Yeah, there are a number of ways to do it. I mean, aquaculture is thousands of years old. So, I mean, that's literally just about trying to grow product in the water. The difference about the modern age is that now we're able to actually do it in a way where we're actually adding to the wild population. So we'll take broodstock out of the water. We'll, you know, in February, warm the temperature of the water up so it kind of tricks it into thinking it's summer when it would naturally spawn. And we can create a next generation of oysters kind of out of sync with nature, which allows us to continually add oysters back to the process, which makes it a sustainable industry, versus always having to depend on the wild stock for our seed for the next year.
Oh, that's so interesting. And oysters are awesome too, because they clean the water they're in, right? So they actually improve the ecology of the bay.
Yeah, it's probably the best thing you can actually eat to improve the environment. You know, our friend Barton the Seaver has often stated, hey, if you want to save the world, eat an oyster, a farm-raised oyster. We say that our work isn't sustainable, it's restorative. Because for every oyster we sell to a restaurant, we're probably putting 12 oysters back into the water. Where we have our three major oyster farms, the wild population around them is increasing because of all the larvae that we put back into the water. The subaquatic vegetation that had been dredged up is coming back.
Oh, wow.
So, and that provides sanctuary for baby marine organisms from, you know, baby rockfish, crabs. We've had seahorses on our cages. So everything kind of comes, it's, you know, it's a full cycle, but oysters are the building block of the Chesapeake Bay and most marine ecosystems.
And there's no adding food to this. I mean, they're eating food that's ambient in the water. So, you know, unlike the, you know, a cow conversion where it's like 7 pounds of feed to get a pound of beef, you know, we're not adding any, we don't feed the animals at all. So it's the most energy efficient food source you'll find.
Yeah. And famously, oysters taste like their environment. They taste like the water you put them in. So it sounds like there can be a real level of creativity to what you do in terms of farming the oysters and playing with, you know, flavors and maybe even textures. Can you talk about that?
At its essence, we call it miroir. So we ripped off the terroir terminology from the wine industry and applied it to oysters. So oysters take on the characteristics of the marine environment where they grow, whether that's the type of strains of algae in the water, salinity, pulling some nutrients off the vegetation that's around, the minerality in the water. They take on those different characteristics. In the old days, like if you Google oyster tins Chesapeake, you'll see there were thousands of different appellations of oyster company names. Each stretch of all of the rivers had different nuances and flavors, and we had lost that. So we tried to actually bring that back. You know, early on, we went to Grand Central and noticed that they had probably 20 oysters from, 2 mile radius.
That's the Grand Central Oyster Bar, you mean?
Yeah.
In New York.
You know,
yeah.
So, exactly. They had, you know, 20 varieties from Massachusetts off the Cape, but they had one from the entire Chesapeake, and it was just called Chesapeake. So we want to kind of bring back those the nomenclature from before.
The right. cool thing is that, I mean, the Maroir effect is going to happen no matter where you grow an oyster. It's going to taste like that region. But then, you know, as we evolve and as we get better at this, you start realizing that, you know, just like vintners, you start to control a lot of the process. You know what kind of exposure you obviously pick your site. You put them at different levels in the water column, which will affect their access to food and oxygen. Mm. And, you know, you can affect which type of grasses they're going to be near. You can plant different types of grasses. So there's all sorts of different ways that you can start adding layers and nuances to the oysters that are, you know, that are your own.
So Ryan, so from 2001 till now, you know, it's almost 20 years later. What do you see? I mean, how has the world, the Chesapeake oyster, changed? I mean, I think the first documented records of people seeing the Chesapeake was that there were so many oysters, the shells were piled up almost like mountains coming out of the water. Now, in 01, when you started, you said that was essentially all gone. What are you seeing now, almost 20 years later?
Yeah, so just that arc is so fascinating. Our peak was probably like in the 1890s, where we were doing about 20 million bushels a year out of the Chesapeake Bay. In 2001, it was 21,000 bushels. Today, our company alone is doing twice as much as the entire bay did in 2001. So right now, we're doing about, I think the Chesapeake Bay is around 600,000 bushels a year that it's producing, which is the largest on the East Coast. So we've kind of gone from, you know, zero to first in a pretty short period of time, and I don't see it slowing down anytime soon, and we're still at such a fraction of the biomass that there's so much more room to go.
Cool. Let's eat some oysters. Everyone
eat
oysters.
Right? Yeah, how often can you say that, to actually go out and eat more seafood? I mean, so much of what we tell people is about restraint, but with oysters, it really is one of those things that we can encourage gluttony.
Cool. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Travis and Ryan Croxton are the owners of the Rappahannock Oyster Company on the Chesapeake Bay. And you can find a recipe for fried oysters from the terrific Southern chef Bill Smith on splendidtable.org. And now, I want to introduce you to a friend of mine. He doesn't actually know who I am, but Thomas Stewart is a friend to pretty much anybody who's ever bellied up to the oyster bar at Pascal's Manali Restaurant in New Orleans. He's got a celebrity smile, and he's a bad dude with an oyster knife.
I'm Thomas Stewart, a.k.a. Uptown T, Pascal Manali's restaurant. Been here for 25 years, shucking oysters. Here I am. I'm not going to say I'm the best at it all, but I'm one of the best through the city of New Orleans. No brag. Gotcha. It took me about 2 weeks and a half, maybe, just to learn how to get it open. And once I learned how to get it open, then I was told to cut it. I have the front. And I call it a butt. That's the back of the oyster. But I just give it a little nudge, give it a little twist, get all that out of there, and there you have it, oyster shuck. To control the knife is to control the oyster. And don't be afraid of hurting yourself. That's how you learned how to ride a bike, huh? People come in sometime every day, every other day, have their dozen oysters. You know, people have their own preferences on what they like. If you like horseradish, go for it. If you love olive oil, put it on your skin, rub it, you know, whatever you want to do with it. It's fun, it's crazy. You have to be back here to really see the difference in what people do. You have people like, oh man, I'm gonna come in here one day and eat 15 dozen oysters. I say, okay, come on by. I'll be here, help me out, keep me busy. So this is what I do, shucking oysters and making people happy. Voila.
See, you hear all that swagger in his voice. He's earned it. Because he can shuck a dozen oysters in a quarter of the time it'll take you to eat them. And, you know, all you have to do is swallow. And I love hearing a man with that kind of pride, because I remember when I learned to shuck oysters, I was a wreck. Like, I was working the appetizer station of a restaurant where, honestly, most of my job was dressing salads, and even then I could struggle to keep up, but when an order for oysters came in, it was like my station was the Bermuda Triangle. Like no food was ever going to come out of it ever again. And, you know, I'd be sitting there struggling and I'd miss the hinge of the shelf with my knife, or I'd break the shells, or, you know, I'd poke in too hard and gash the oyster meat. And so I was just terrible. But as I got a little better at it, Like once in a while, I could feel like exactly the right resistance when I knew I had the knife in enough. Or I could just tell how firm I had to twist my wrist to pop the hinge open. And every time I could hit it, like I felt like I was a new person. See, the thing with oyster shucking is that it looks like it's brute force, but it's really this incredible, like delicate, sensitive dance between your wrist and your eye, and it's a craft that few people perfect. So when you go to an oyster bar and you see someone like Thomas Stewart, watch how easy they make it look, and know that you are in the presence of greatness. And actually, if you do want to watch Thomas work, that clip we heard of him before, that was from a video of him shucking oysters shot by GoNola.com. You can find a link for it at SplendidTable.org. And coming up, we'll hear the story of Thomas Downing, the Oyster King of New York. And we'll get the essentials on oyster eating from America's Test Kitchen. We'll be back. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Oysters are usually seen as a luxury now, but back in the day, they were so abundant they were an everyman food. Like in coastal cities, you could have them on the street or in dingy bars for practically nothing. But a man named Thomas Downing, in the early 1800s in New York, built an empire out of an oyster bar. And even Queen Victoria was a fan of his oysters. Now today, it's sort of a cliche to call someone the first celebrity chef. But Downing was one of America's first celebrity restaurateurs. But here's the thing. He was a black man, doing this during the era of slavery. Joanne Hippolyte is a curator at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and she came in to tell us more of Thomas's story. Hi, Dr. Hippolyte.
Hi, Francis.
So can you tell us about Thomas Downing, who he was, and how he made his fortune in oysters?
Thomas Downing was a restaurateur. He was a caterer. He was a abolitionist. He was many things, but he's most well known, as you just mentioned here, for his oyster restaurant called Thomas Downing's Oyster House in New York City. And this was during the 19th century.
Mm. And where did he come from? How did he become an oysterman?
Thomas Downing was an African-American man. His parents were actually enslaved people who were set free by their Virginia slave masters. So he grew up a free man on Chincoteague Island, which is on the eastern shores of Virginia. So his lifestyle, his family's lifestyle, they owned property on the island, was very much, you know, clamming, digging, raking oysters, fishing. That was his everyday livelihood and his family's livelihood.
And how did he come to New York?
He ends up moving out of Virginia. He follows the troops north after the War of 1812, spends about 7 years in Philadelphia, where we understand that he was running an oyster bar. So he moves from raking oysters to actually working in an oyster bar. And then in New York, we find him stirring up in the census around 1819, and he's listed as an oysterman. Now, this was an occupation that a number of African-American men in New York held. So he's the kind of person that would have gone out on a boat or a schooner and helped harvest some of the oysters from the many beds in New York City's waters and brought them back and either sold them to the various marketplaces that then sold them to restaurants, or he peddled them on the streets. We're not exactly sure, but he's definitely harvesting them at that period of time.
Do we know how he goes from there to not only having a restaurant, but having, as I understand, an extraordinarily successful restaurant?
By the mid-1820s, we know he's opened an oyster refectory. That's what they're called at that time, or an oyster cellar. And they're called cellars because you actually go down the stairs to enter these spaces.
Oh, and cellar with a C.
Yeah, with a C, exactly. And this is another occupation that a number of African-American had. So he wasn't the only African-American who owned an oyster cellar, but he quickly distinguished himself for having a cellar like no other. He operated two properties that were adjoined to each other on Broad Street, And so that gave him an expansive footprint. So these other oyster cellars were known as rough and tumble places with, you know, dim lights and a crowd that you weren't sure if you were safe with your goods in these establishments. But Thomas Downing had, again, I said, an expansive footprint. So he had a large dining area. He had curtains and he had a fine carpet. He was known for having a chandelier in his space. So this was fine dining. And his clientele were largely white men, men of means, merchants, bankers, Wall Street officials, and newspaper men.
And so his place sort of became like the watering hole for the elite, right? It was like that was their spot.
Yeah, that's where he really distinguished himself. He owned probably the best known oyster restaurant in New York City, owned by any white or black person at that period of time. And it was the place to be for visiting dignitaries, for travelers from different countries, for merchants, and also men of means would bring their wives there to eat.
Is that unusual at that time?
It is unusual because the place has to be respectable. That's where you get to understand that his is different from all the oyster cellars. You want to bring them to a place where ladies' sensibilities are not going to be disturbed, right?
Oh, how delicate.
Yes.
But actually, this is actually really interesting because now I think, you know, we have to put ourselves in the mindset of, as you said, this was in the 1800s, right? And now I think if you think of an oyster restaurant, I think we could automatically assume it to be nice, oysters are expensive, they're an elite food. But back then, oysters were, they could be an everyday food, they could be an everyman kind of food, right? And so for him to lavish this kind of care and attention and luxury it sounded unique.
Yeah, oysters were incredibly inexpensive back then. They were eaten by all classes. And so, I mean, I think that what I've read is that for 6 cents, you can get a dozen, you know? So,
oh, wow.
And that's because they were so plentiful. And so when Thomas Downing enters this market, he finds a way to distinguish himself by making it a place where the upper class, the elite, the merchant class, the people of means are looking for a sort of a sense of refinement, right? A sense of class in certain places where they dine. And that's where he finds his niche.
So he was incredibly successful. He owned the place that the elite came. And I heard somewhere that when he passed away, the Chamber of Commerce, like the New York City Chamber of Commerce, all came to his funeral. Is that true?
Yeah, I heard that they closed for the day, actually, as well, for his funeral. He certainly gained a lot of social and political capital because of the clientele that he served, these men of means, these men that had connections throughout New York City. They seem to have had quite a bit of respect for him. And when Thomas Downing got into trouble every once in a while, I think he could pull on these connections that he had to back him up, to support him. There are these stories, for instance, of African-American oystermen who owned these more ordinary cellars. Mm-hmm. Currency during that period of time wasn't always stable. And so there were these fake levels of currency, right? Fake money that people would pay for their food with, and you could spot them. Yeah, absolutely. None of that seemed to happen at Thomas Downing's Oyster House. He knew he could get the backup of his own clientele to support him if he was calling a particular currency of a customer into question, whereas other African-American men didn't have that kind of support and often had to deal with the fact that they were being swindled.
Oh. He seemed to also be very important to different communities, that community that we just talked about, but also people fleeing enslavement. His place was a stop on the Underground Railroad, is that right?
It was. So on the one hand, here's Thomas dining with this exclusive white clientele at his restaurant, right? It's only for white diners. And on the other hand, he's this significant community figure and activist in the African-American community. He harbored refugees, slaves. Slaves on the run in the cellars themselves, and he was also well known for, after New York had abolished slavery in 1837, he helped found the Committee of 13, which was this organization that was working to protect free people from being, you know, kidnapped and being sold back into the South, actually, as we know from the story of Solomon Northrop and 12 right. Years of Slave.
Let me pull this back a little bit. So you're a curator in the Cultural Expressions Gallery of the museum. And Thomas Downing's story isn't the only place in your galleries where oysters appear. Why does that food hold prominence in the story of the African-American experience?
I think it helps us, and oysters help us interpret identity, interpret historical circumstances. So there are several circumstances where you see oysters showing up throughout our 13 permanent exhibitions at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And one of them, I think, that is most poignant is in the Slavery and Freedom exhibition, there are these displays of oyster shells. And we're told through the label that these were used by children on Edisto Island in particular, so it's a waterside community, African-American community, enslaved children to eat. So there's this moment when you're encountering these oyster shells and you realize the disparity visually, this visual disparity between enslaved people and free people, the fact that they would have to use these discarded, you know, remnants of things to use as utensils as opposed to the knives mm-hmm. and forks that people with better means would have access to.
Yeah. Well, this is so interesting. Thank you so much, Dr. Hippolyte.
Thank you.
Joanne Hippolyte is a curator at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And you can find a recipe for a classic, oyster stew, on splendidtable.org. Okay, so if you're just getting into oysters, or really, like, if you already eat them like an otter, we have a terrific guide to buying and eating oysters for you. Our producer Sally Swift got the rundown from Dan Souza. So Dan was a cook in a seafood restaurant, and his family origins span both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. He's also the editor-in-chief of Cook's Illustrated magazine. So they talked about the real-life stuff.
Hey, Dan, great to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You know, we have been talking about oysters all hour, and we have come to you to get some basics covered because there are opportunities everywhere for people to eat oysters these days. So I want to start, like, right at the beginning with the big question, true or false that we should eat them only in the R months?
Well, so this used to be true, and it technically still is today if you're eating wild oysters. Wild oysters were kind of the norm back in the last century, but nowadays we pretty much eat exclusively cultivated oysters. And the reason for the rule was the months without an R, so we're talking about May, June, July, and August, essentially the summer, was spawning season for oysters. And oysters that are spawning just don't have a very good texture. Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't so much about, you know, it's not safe to eat them in the summer. It was that they don't have the best texture. Nowadays, because we're eating farmed oysters, you can enjoy them throughout the year.
And we are mostly eating farmed oysters, correct?
That's correct. By and large, you're eating farmed oysters. There are still a few areas, if you get them from Europe in particular, that there are still some wild harvested oysters. But for the majority of the oysters that you're getting, they're all farmed.
Okay. And what do we need to look for when we are buying them?
So the key to buying oysters is you want them to be alive and well when you buy them. And this is true. not true of all foods that we eat, but definitely shellfish and oysters. It's really, really important. So the first thing is, if you think of them like produce, you want to buy them at a place that goes through a lot of oysters. Mm-hmm. In the same way that you don't want to go to a store that has produce lying around for weeks and weeks and getting worse. The next thing is you want to make sure that the lid on the oyster is tightly closed at all times. That means that it's got plenty of moisture inside and all that nice liquor in there. It means that it's also alive. So a really good fishmonger will do this trick, and this is an important thing mm-hmm. to look for, is they'll pick up two oysters and they'll gently knock them together. Mm-hmm. And what the fishmonger is doing is listening to the sound that they make. And so if an oyster is really packed with liquor, it's tightly closed, it's going to make a really deep thud. If it sounds hollow, that means that a lot of that liquor has drained out, and that oyster is either dead or at least not very healthy. So if you see your fishmonger doing that, that's great, and they should kind of self-select the ones that that are good.
I have never seen a fishmonger do that, I have to admit.
Yeah, so the really good places, they will do that, and they know to do that. And I think the final point is, in terms of the size of the oyster that you're buying is really mm-hmm. important. You can eat an oyster that's very small or one that's really big, and they're all delicious, and they never really get tough even as they get quite large. But you have some challenges. When there's a really large oyster, it's going to be pretty tough to open, and it might be a little too much for whoever's eating it to kind of slurp it down in one. And it's on the other end, if it's too small, you're opening more oysters to feed people, which is, it's a hard task to open them. And it can be a little bit more difficult to get your oyster knife in there. So look for average size oysters with a nice deep cup and a fishmonger who sells a lot of them and knows that nice knocking trick.
That is great advice. And then what do we do? What's the best way for us to store them when we get them home?
So for storage, just like with all seafood and especially live seafood, cold is your friend. You want to get them as cold as possible without them freezing. And the real key to that is using ice. So the best method is put the oysters in a colander, cover them with ice, and put that colander in another bowl. What that allows you to do is basically have those oysters touching ice, and then as it melts, it drains away. And that's really, really key. You don't want to do what I did when I worked at a very fancy French seafood restaurant where I forgot to take the oysters out of the ice and let them sit overnight in it. And as that ice melted, they were surrounded by fresh water and they died. So oysters love salt water. They die in fresh water. So you always want to have a place for that fresh water that's melted off the ice to drain away.
I had no idea. And you know, that crushed ice that restaurants serve oysters on is really there for a reason. I mean, oysters taste much better when they're raw and they are cold.
Absolutely. So we love oysters nice and cold, and crushed ice really is perfect for it for a couple of reasons. One is when you get oysters at the table, if they're coming on something like salt or a bed of greens or something like that, when they arrive at the table, that is the coldest they will ever be.
Right.
So you feel a certain kind of rush to eat them because you want to eat them where they're nice and chilled. If they show up on a bed of crushed ice, it means that you have plenty of time to hang out with them. They're just going to get colder and they're going to stay for a long time. So you can have sips of wine and oysters and kind of, you know, have a good time with whoever you're dining with and not worry that the oysters are not going to be as good as they sit.
That is the way to go. So I want to get to cooking in a minute, but I need to know, are you a sauce on or a sauce off person with your raw oysters? I find this divides oyster eaters.
Yeah, well, so I would say my guess is that it probably divides oyster eaters over their lifetime, because I know for myself, I used to use a lot more sauces than I do now.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started eating them, I liked cocktail sauce, I liked mignonette, even hot sauce. I think I was getting used to the taste of the oyster and the texture and all the newness of it. As time's gone on, I kind of switched over to just using lemon. And my preferred way now is with no sauce at all, but with a really nice, steely, bright white wine, kind of as the acidic component. So sipping on that and eating the oysters. But yeah, I think there's no shame in using sauces, but I think you taste it the most when there's nothing else.
Okay, so let's get into cooking them. So what are your favorite ways of dealing with them with heat?
So there's a ton of different ways to cook oysters. I think something that's really important to keep in mind is oysters are pretty mild. So if you're going to take them out and batter them and fry them and put them in a really flavorful, you know, dipping sauce, like, you're going to lose a lot of that oyster flavor. For me, the only way I really like to cook oysters is on the grill. And it's also just dead simple. If you have a lot of people coming over and you don't want to spend the time shucking oysters, it couldn't be any simpler. So you start with a medium hot grill. You place the oysters, which you've scrubbed really well. Then they're going to go on a medium hot grill, kind of cup side up, put a lid on it, and just go for a couple minutes. All you're looking for is that shell to pop open just a little bit, and it's not going to pop open wide. Once that happens, take them off the grill. And I like to have a landing zone where I've taken a big sheet of aluminum foil and kind of crumpled it up a little bit and basically made a nest out of foil where they can come off and they can sit right on that. And that keeps them upright so that you don't lose any of that nice liquor.
Mm-hmm.
Once they're over there, you just want to get any knife. And this can be a paring knife, a butter knife. If you have an oyster knife, that's great. And you're just going to slide in that big opening that you now have access to and sever the adductor muscle on top. And take that top shell off and then slide it underneath and sever the adductor muscle on the bottom. Then they're ready to go. So you can serve them with lemon wedges, with, you know, different sauces, flavored butters. It's really the easiest possible way to serve oysters. And because you're not doing a lot to them, they're just kind of enhanced by the grill, but not overpowered by any flavors.
And are they cooked or are they just warmed up?
For the most part, you know, if you keep going, you can definitely cook them. I like them just kind of gently warmed. You see that they'll tighten up a little bit, firm up a little bit with the heat, and you could keep going longer if you wanted to, but I think you get the nicest experience if they're just kind of warmed up, a little bit of grill flavor, and easier to open.
That sounds delicious. And what do you do with those? You know, you often find tubs of shucked oysters. What do you like to do with those? Do you ever take them on?
The tubs of oysters, if they're coming from a good fishmonger and they're fresh, I think those are great if you want to make an oyster stew, which is actually a pretty classic dish, or if you wanted to do a deep fried oyster, those are the ones that I would go for. It's going to be a ton of work otherwise, and you know, you're not going to notice the differences in how they were shucked once they're battered and fried.
That makes sense. Okay, I have one last question about eating oysters.
Okay.
So we're seeing a lot of dollar oyster places these days for happy hour? Is that a yes. good thing or a bad thing? I'm afraid to ask.
So if I only had one answer for this, my answer would be no. Mm-hmm. It's not a good idea, but it's a little more nuanced than that. Is I think you have to look at the place that is selling the oysters. So if this is a restaurant that serves a lot of seafood, that often serves oysters at full price and is offering a discounted price on them, I think that's probably a pretty good bet, and I would check them out. If, on the other hand, it's a bar or restaurant that really doesn't focus on seafood, doesn't have oysters very much, and is really trying to just get people in the door, I would be a lot more wary of going to that establishment. Mm-hmm. And it really comes down to best practices. The stuff that we talk about, storing them really cold, knowing how to properly open an oyster, that's all going to come with working with oysters a lot. I think if you go in and you order, the sure sign that you don't want to be eating those oysters is if they look like they were opened by seagulls. And by that I mean the way seagulls open oysters.
Massacred.
Is they pick them up and they fly really high in the air and they drop them on rocks. And so they're open, but there's shards of shell everywhere. There's dirt in them. The adductor muscle wasn't cut well. You can look at them and tell pretty quickly if they were handled with care. Not served on ice.
Okay, it's the seagull test.
The seagull test, yeah. And that's your final guide.
That is funny. Good advice. Hey, thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Ellie.
Dan Souza is the editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated magazine. And you can find the recipe for grilled oysters with spicy lemon butter at splendidtable.org. And coming up, we have a story about a woman looking for herself in an oyster bar. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Hi, it's Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So when you're thinking about your local Chinese takeout place, I'm guessing you're usually not thinking about the fresh brine of oysters. But oysters are everywhere there. Oyster sauce, I mean, which is one of Earth's greatest condiments. It's this thick, dark, syrupy goo of bottomless umami. But what is it? I mean, I've been eating it my whole life, and I actually have no idea what oyster sauce is or how it's made. So I got in touch with one of the country's best young Chinese-American chefs, Brandon Ju, because he makes oyster sauce himself for his restaurant. Hey, chef, how are you?
Hey, Francis.
As we tape today, it is the Lunar New Year, Chinese New Year, so Happy New Year to you, my brother.
Happy New Year. You're the dog. Yeah.
Dog's up. So, all right, so I love oyster sauce, and you love oyster sauce.
I do.
You know, anyone who's ever had beef and broccoli loves oyster sauce, whether they know it or not.
It's true.
But let me ask you, what is oyster sauce?
I mean, for the most part, the way I describe oyster sauce is like almost like if barbecue sauce and fish sauce had like a child. And it's
pungent child that had trouble making friends in the schoolyard.
That's right. Yeah, stinky.
But it was really sweet once you got to know.
That's right. It is sweet. And that's the characteristic of, I think, oyster sauce is that it has this sweetness, but it has like a really saline undertone to it.
Yeah.
That I think is like a really nice balance that kind of almost tastes very natural to seafood, like that sweetness that you find in seafood. In general terms, the oyster sauce is this reduction of, you know, as purely oyster flavor as you can get. Uh-huh. And I think that's a combination of, you know, you want to highlight some things that are actually characteristics of oysters. So the sweetness. Mm-hmm. So for sweetness, we use brown rice syrup and molasses. The fermented, robust kind of like end of the oyster sauce comes from fermented bean paste with a lot of aromatics, so ginger, soy, anchovy, tamarind, garlic. Those are all the seasonings behind, you know, getting that sauce to kind of round out.
Mm, so you cook those together with those.
That's
with
right.
The molasses and the brown rice syrup.
That's right. Yeah, and the first thing we actually do though is we shuck raw oysters, and we take the shells and we make a stock with just the shells. And
what?
I know this is. I'm gonna,
you're going into outer space now.
I know, but it's like when I thought of how do I really get to this actual flavor, it's gonna take really reducing this flavor down as much as I can. So once we shuck the oysters, we save all the liquor, we add that to the shells, we make a stock with seaweed, ginger, and all that liquid. And once that kind of steeps for, I'd say like 2 or 3 hours, we strain it and we poach the oysters in that broth. And then after we do that, we dehydrate the oysters.
Yeah.
We then take garlic, ginger, onion, tamarind, anchovy, and we fry the dehydrated oysters in that. Then we start adding a little bit of malt vinegar and then the sugars.
Yeah.
So the molasses, the brown rice syrup, and then soy, and then fermented bean paste to kind of round out the very last part of it. And then it all just gets pureed.
Yeah.
And after all that, I'm still like tinkering with measurements. That's why like I have a recipe for you, Francis, but it's like it's definitely a working recipe.
Yeah, and it is definitely a working recipe.
There's a lot of variables, so there's a lot of things.
I like that step 3 is make the stock with the oyster shells, and step 14 is. But okay, well, this is amazing because you know this is a level of complexity and depth in the preparation. Certainly, I'd never considered, and I think it's so interesting because right now we're in a moment where chefs of many different cuisines are really interested in making. You know, making their own breads, making their own charcuterie, making their own pickles. And yet for Asian cuisines, people still feel like, oh, all that stuff you just go to the store and buy. And so I'm fascinated by why you chose to make this thing.
You know, thinking about my own ethos of how I want to eat and also the integrity that I want to have behind my food, knowing that I can tell people that come to the restaurant that we've taking all these steps to make sure that all of the food that's being served is, you know, organic, local, small farmed, like food mm-hmm. and things that we believe in. And I think when you have that ethos, but then you have these bottles of like oyster sauce and stuff like that, it just doesn't make sense. A big part of my frustration about even Chinese food's progression has been that it has relied on too much of the pantry to be store-bought.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, there was no like, you know, differentiation of Chinese American food throughout America mm-hmm. because all of it was being, you know, outsourced basically.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Chef.
Of course.
This is really a lot to think about.
Yeah.
And all that from beef and broccoli. Brandon Ju is the chef owner of Mr. Ju's in San Francisco. So every once in a while, I come across a story that just stuns me. You know, it just hits me and makes me see something in a way I never expected. We're going to close the show with one of those. It's from Alicia Kennedy. It's about eating oysters, how she loves to eat oysters, but it's not about their hit of salt or their long, cucumbery finish. It's about, well, you'll see.
I've been eating oysters. Now, this wouldn't be news, but I've been vegan for 5 years. I'm a vegan food writer, and I depend on my nut cheese diet. I've abandoned it for midday lunches that I can't share on Instagram. I started eating oysters soon after my brother's sudden death. On my first trip out of the house alone, I went to the John Dory Oyster Bar for a book party. There, a table of oysters, 4 varieties on ice, were the centerpiece of the room. I got a cocktail and sat by the window, stared at the oysters, thinking about past summer lunches on restaurant decks that jutted out into the Great South Bay. What was it my dad always ordered on the half shell? Clams or were they oysters? Either way, my brother never ate them. The smell of seafood made him cry as a baby. In his 26 years on Earth, that never changed. But he would wave chicken wings in my face every time I tried to go vegetarian as a teenager. Meat was always something we could agree on. Taco Bell, gyros at our neighborhood Greek restaurant, chicken fingers. When I quit meat, he took it personally. Every time we ate together after that, my brother shook his head, confused and annoyed by my choice not to be who I was as a child. On our last vacation together, a few months before he passed, he was still offering me chicken fingers. Now, at this oyster bar, in a fog of grief, I didn't know why I was doing anything, much less not eating oysters. I walked to the table and quickly put two on a plate, hunched over, and slurped them down. The brine, the fleshiness, immediately made me feel alive, and only slightly guilty. God had taken someone from me, and I could inhale some of his creatures in exchange. I first confessed my sin to my mother. Then my boyfriend became an accomplice in extravagant oyster lunches. I dabbled in mussels, but they didn't have the same immediacy. You needed a utensil. They weren't raw. Oysters, fleshy and immediate and always still tasting of the sea where they lived, satisfied my new, deep rage. I'd cared so much for so long about animals, even letting my choice disconnect me from people I loved. Now there didn't seem to be a point in trying so hard to be a good vegan anymore. I started thinking about going beyond oysters. A secret visit to Brooklyn's Peter Luger Steakhouse became a common fantasy. There, I could draw blood. I could suck marrow from a bone. On Christmas Eve, with family, I got drunk and confessed to all of them. I've been eating oysters. I told my cousins and my aunts and uncles that I wanted to eat something alive, take something away from God. Everyone understood. Everyone had been there to see me scream when I saw him in the casket. That night, my uncle told me a story. When I was very small, my grandma would take me to a restaurant to watch me eat an entire lobster. She thought it was funny, he said, that my little body could contain such a large appetite. I was always encouraged to satisfy that appetite, to eat everything. The point is, maybe veganism was against my very nature. These days, the intense fog of grief lifts on occasion, and I can make sense of my choice. Or at least, I know that I have to impose some order, or who knows what else grief could make me do. My brother, who never stopped wanting me to give up veganism and eat a damn chicken finger, will have to be a better ghost if he wants to get his wish. I keep eating oysters. It's not about vengeance anymore. They feel no pain, I read. When I have a chance between appointments, I sit at the Grand Central Oyster Bar and have my boring old order of blue points judged by the gruff man behind it. I'm from the same place as these oysters, I want to tell him. I'm trying to taste the past. I'm trying to taste what it would be like to be someone I used to be. Someone whose brother was still alive.
Alicia Kennedy is a writer for The Village Voice and other publications, and this story was based on a piece she wrote for Hazlitt. And that's our show this week. Thank you so much for listening, and until next week, eat well, drink well, and tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. I mean, thanks to everyone who's contributed and made this show possible. We literally could not do it without you. To help support our show, head to splendidtable.org.
And while you're there, look around. There are tons of recipes, info on all our guests, and a whole bunch of videos. And you can sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it'll make your Monday to Friday cooking a little easier and a little tastier. And subscribe to our podcast. And if you like us, please leave us a review. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny J. Lou Lukey is our editor and technical director. And Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Thanks to Teresa Burgess for pinch hitting this week. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.